This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley.
You know, Richard, you're all talk and you do nothing. You've been a failure at every job you have ever had.
He believes that after 42 years in politics, he's entitled to be governor.
That was Mike DeWine, and Republican candidate for Ohio governor, and Richard Cordray, the Democratic candidate, near the opening of their debate on Wednesday night in Dayton. The candidates were asked about gun control, the opioid epidemic, college affordability, what would happen if the Supreme Court overturns Roe versus Wade, Issue 1, and other potential areas of difference. To discuss how the candidates did in the debate and how the debates might impact the election, we are joined today by the Ohio Public Radio's Statehouse News reporter, Joe Ingles, Cincinnati Enquirer State Government reporter, Jesse Ballmert, and WVXU politics reporter, Howard Wilkinson. You can join our discussion by calling 513-419-7100 or emailing us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Welcome, everyone, to Cincinnati Edition. Good to have you here today.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So, Joe, let's start with you. Going into the debate on Wednesday night, what did each of the candidates have to show given the dynamics of the campaign thus far? What did they go in? What do you think their personal goals were in these debates?
Well, I think for Mike DeWine, he wanted to go in and show that he had experience, and he wanted to use his name recognition, you know, in a way that could, you know, put people could actually see him and say, oh, yeah, he did this and he did that, you know, and actually remember him. And Cordray, I think because he hasn't been in politics here recently, didn't have that advantage of being in the news as much as Mike DeWine has in the recent years. And so he had to go in and he had to remind people, yep, I'm an Ohioan and I was here and I did this and that. And I think both of them had to overcome a common obstacle, which is both of these guys are very smart when you talk to them, and they tend to qualify their answers very heavily, and they tend to get wonky and nerdy and that sort of thing. And I think both of them had to figure out a way to be conversational and resonate with the audience. And by and large, I think both of them did that. I think they gave nice, short, and concise answers that made sense.
Jesse, what did you think in terms of how they did?
Well, like Joe said, I think Rich Cordray needed to reintroduce Ohioans to who he was. Obviously, he was a treasurer and attorney general in Ohio, but the U.S. Consumer Financial Protection Bureau wasn't an agency that probably most Ohioans were watching every TikTok of, unless you were a bank employee or a credit union employee. So I think he did a good job at that. I have watched Rich Cordray speeches previously, and they have been not succinct. They've not been to the point and not very energetic. And I think he memorized a few one-liners, a few zingers, and you saw that. And I think just the preparation for the debate was marked on his behalf. Mike DeWine always comes off as like a bit folksy and knowledgeable. And I think he was able to do that. There were a few instances where he looked a little, didn't have the words for the next thing. But I think candidates on both sides are going to do that from time to time.
Howard, I've heard a lot of Democratic officials locally say before this debate, they needed to see some fire in the belly from Cordray. They hadn't seen it.
Right.
Do you think they would have been happy with what they saw?
Yes, they were. All the ones I've talked to. I mean, he does have fire in his belly. People who don't understand that don't know Rich Cordray. If you go back to 2010 when these two were running against each other for Ohio Attorney General, and Cordray was in that office and DeWine was out of office for one of the few times in his adult life, they went at it. And Richard Cordray can be that kind of fiery speaker. He is very clever. He is very smart. He doesn't need to. I don't think he. I mean, yeah, there's a certain amount of lines you memorize, but he's good on his feet too. And I thought, you know, DeWine was good, but he wasn't that. I mean, he was always, he seemed almost defensive about a lot of the things that Cordray was saying about him. And he was, you know, kept turning to him and said, "Why are you laughing? Are you laughing? What's, there's nothing funny about this." And it just didn't come over as a person of, you know, great confidence in himself or in what he was saying.
You know, one of the problems I had as I watched the debate, online actually, was when DeWine was saying those things, that why are you laughing? He did that at least twice, maybe three times. Yeah. The screen wasn't wide enough. The shot wasn't wide enough that you could actually see what Cordray was doing. I don't know if it was – I didn't know if that was a setup line that DeWine was using. And, you know, there is – we have a caller who's called in that has asked the question, what about the structure of this debate, pointing out that the Green Party was left out? What do you say about that?
I say that the rules of the debate that were set up by the commission excluded any political party that wasn't polling 10% or more.
Joe, Jesse, one of you were about to jump in on that one, too.
Yeah, I think the simple answer is they didn't meet the rules to participate. There can be some question about whether those rules are fair. Mm-hmm. Why not just include everyone and let the variety and spectrum of political ideas come about? Four candidates is certainly easier than like the 16 plus that we had in the Republican GOP presidential primary. But there is an argument to be made that Rich Cordray and Mike DeWine are the two likely candidates to be elected in this race. And, you know, hearing their opinions is important.
I think it would be important to hear the Green Party candidate and the Libertarian Party candidate in terms of what kind of issues they raise that they may force the other two, the major party candidates, to talk about that they otherwise wouldn't talk about. That's, to me, their function. But neither one of them are going to be governor of the state of Ohio. The next governor of the state of Ohio is either going to be Mike DeWine or Rich Cordray. But they can have an impact just with raising issues that the other candidates do not.
Yeah, I would have liked to have seen maybe after the debate have, you know, them weigh in on what they saw and their thoughts about the debate. I think that would be a really great follow-up, and it would have been nice if we would have had that opportunity statewide to tune in somewhere and watch them respond. But, you know, when you've only got an hour for a debate, you know, I think the thinking is focus on those two people who are most likely to be in the governor's chair next year. And, you know, you only got an hour, and that's not much time. There were a lot of subjects, a lot of issues that they didn't have time to get to in this debate. And if they would have had a Green Party candidate and a Libertarian Party candidate in there, they wouldn't have got to as much as they did.
Well, you know, one of the things that I think I brought up the last time the three of you and four of us were together was that I, again, didn't see quite as hard from Cordray as I expected, was hitting at the issues that the Republican Party has with some scandals, some corruption issues, and maybe raising that as this is what you get when you have one party in power across the elected government for too long. And ECOT came up, but other than that, I didn't see him going after that issue. Jesse or Joe, what do you think about that?
Well, I know there was a question specifically about ECOT and who was responsible for ECOT and better policing it and what they would do differently. So I know they both responded to that question. Yeah, Rich Cordray didn't go after Cliff Rosenberger, the Speaker of the Ohio House, who resigned amid an FBI investigation, or some of the other lawmakers who have resigned. I don't know if those are things that the average voter knows as much about or can point to, but it's certainly a line of attack that you might see in the future.
And I think Cordray tended, he wanted to... you know, he's reintroducing himself here. He kind of came off kind of funny, you know. He had some zingers in there, as Jesse said, and kind of, you know, a little bit of levity there. When you start bringing up all the scandals and hitting really hard, you have the potential to come off sounding mean. And I think, you know, they kind of want to, at least in the first debate, until people get to know what they're about, I think... you know, they want to steer clear of that.
Howard, do you think this is something he's got in his back pocket?
Yeah, I mean, he has to. I mean, he really has to have that in his back pocket. And I don't think he has to do a recitation of every little scandal that's happened up there, because, you know, there have been plenty of them in Columbus. But he does have to make an argument to the people of Ohio. Said, look, this is what one party government for such a long period of time produces. It produces an assumption that you can get away with anything or you can do anything. And that he can say that's wrong. And he doesn't have to be strident about it. He doesn't have to be angry about it. He just has to say it.
Yeah, you know, for Cordray, he has an ability to come in and say, you know what, there's a scandal up there and I can clean it up because, look, my own party had a problem when I took over as AG. And I could see him making that link that he's the guy who comes in, cleans up the mess, you know, and I could see that line. He didn't make it in this debate, but, you know, there's a lot left and you know, a lot of time left for him to make that. So, and I do think he has the potential to do that.
Jesse, just before we take a break here, where does this race stand? How close is it? And is this really still in play here?
So it is a pretty close race. I think the most recent poll came out this week, Baldwin Wallace University, and they were within, I think, 5 or 6 percentage points of one another. It was DeWine was leading slightly. I think most polling shows it pretty close. And so, I mean, not to state the obvious, but it's going to depend on who shows up on Election Day. Early voting is going to start on October 10th, and I think that'll give Democrats a good idea of where they stand, because early voting tends to favor Democrats. And, yeah, I think it's anybody's ballgame at
this
point.
And if I read that Baldwin Wallace poll correctly, I think there's 21% undecided.
Yes.
And that's an important thing. There's still a lot of votes out there to be captured. Before we get to the other races, I'd like to pick up on a couple of the issues that were brought up in that debate and explore some of them. One of them is issue one. Kept popping up. Came up several times. And this is the issue that is independent of the gubernatorial race, but all Ohioans will have a chance to vote on it, and it's about reducing the penalties for drug possession, and has implications for people being released from prison. Very controversial. Did the people behind, the organizations behind this issue one, did they hand Mike DeWine a sort of wedge issue that is kind of a golden sort of thing that a candidate would love to have to use against their opponent, Howard?
It's entirely possible. And, you know, because it is a very easy issue to go out and say, you know, what are we talking about? We're not going to put people in jail for, you know, breaking the law. We should make all this essentially legal. And but on the other hand, there's an argument to be made that, you know, the jails are full and these people, particularly the users, not the dealers, but the users, need treatment, not jail. Now, it's going to be I've not seen any kind of polling on this or anything. I don't know if there is. I'm sure there is. But I think DeWine could probably end up doing some ads that are fairly dark about, you know, what the consequences of issue one could be, and pointing out that while he opposes it, Richard Cordray has come out in favor of it.
Yeah. Jesse, what do you think about that? Do you think Mike DeWine is certainly trying to say this is Richard Cordray's proposal, although it's not.
Yeah.
He has supported it. So you think this is a wedge issue?
I think it's certainly a place where you can draw an easy contrast between the two candidates. And so they are. Basically, the proposal would reduce fourth and fifth degree drug possession charges to misdemeanors, and making saying on the first two offenses you wouldn't get any jail time. The question that's come up a lot is with fentanyl, this very dangerous, powerful drug. The way that it's written, up to 20 grams of just under 20 grams of fentanyl would still be a misdemeanor, and that could pack quite a punch. That's something like 10,000 lethal doses. And so that's something that Mike DeWine has certainly pointed out recently. Ohio Governor John Kasich has said he likes some of the concepts, but he's going to vote against this issue because he thinks it has just too many problems. And so Rich Cordray is standing a little bit alone. He has supportive groups like ACLU and the Ohio Education Association, and the groups that are funding this, like Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook fame and the George Soros' organization. But a lot of people have lined up against this one, and I think that could be problematic for Cordray.
Let me go
on. Yeah, but there's one thing that he, you know, when you talk about Cordray standing alone, there's one big group that's standing with him that when you think of crime and order, mm-hmm. you might, that it definitely is in his column. And that's the police, the Ohio Fraternal Order of Police. They've endorsed him. He's got a lot of police people standing with him. And, you know, the problem is that, especially in Ohio, you have these people who are drug offenders, and they get in the prison system, but they're going to get back out. And without getting treatment and the kind of treatment they need, it tends to be a cycle for them.
Well, you know.
And then when they get back out, because they have a record, they can't get a job, and they're miserable because they can't get a job, and there's all these impediments, and it leads them right back into the drug culture, and it's kind of like a revolving door. And this issue one is meant to try to stop that.
Yeah, I'm more interested today in the sort of the political implications of this, and somewhat related on a sort of law, justice, order question is how the gun control question was raised in the debate, particularly the red flag law. The proposed red flag law, and who would sign it, who wouldn't. And Joe, how did you think the two candidates did on that one?
Well, if you look at Mike DeWine, of course, Rich Cordray says that he's all those things he's proposed that are in those red flag laws. He's been behind those for years. But if you look at the way that Mike DeWine answered the question, he said, well, you know, I could go for that red flag law, except I would need some guidelines in it. But we didn't know what those guidelines were. He didn't have time to go into explaining that. And if I had a chance one-on-one to do an interview with Mike DeWine, one of the things that I would ask is, okay, you said that you would support a red flag law with certain guidelines. Tell me what those guidelines are. What's the checklist that it needs to have? Because that's a big issue there. I mean, you could make it so difficult you could put so many guidelines in it that it would be difficult to have the red flag law. And that's what we've seen here in the legislature, at least.
Yeah, he did say that he could support it if, you know, there were protections of people's constitutional rights and right to due process. Under law, that would be, you know, that's the only way in which he could support something like this. But, yeah, I mean, there's going to be more talk of this as we go on.
I thought an interesting area that was raised, and Jesse, let me throw this one at you. Given the Brett Kavanaugh nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court and whether he ends up on the court or There's another. The next justice is probably going to be a conservative. And the question was raised, what if the court pulls back on Roe versus Wade, gets rid of it, sends the whole issue of women's right to abortion back to the states? What will Ohio do? That's a pretty poignant question. How do you think the two candidates did on that one?
I think they responded probably very similar to how you would expect based on their political backgrounds. Rich Cordray has said that he is pro-choice, and Mike DeWine has said that he's pro-life. Mike DeWine has been very favorable of the conservative justices who've been appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and I think, you know, you could expect more restrictions on access to abortion if Mike DeWine were governor, and you could perhaps see a little bit less if Rich Cordray were governor. But I think also it seems likely that the Ohio legislature is going to be controlled by Republicans either way. So it might affect which laws are put out there for them to sign.
Okay. Let's take a look at how this race for governor interacts with the other statewide races. Jesse, from your perspective up in Columbus, attorney general, auditor, state secretary of state, treasurer, which of these races do you think is attracting any attention on its own? And, you know, if this is such a close race for governor, there may not be many coattails for anybody in these lower races. What's the relationship here between the governor's race and these other statewide races?
Well, I think the people that the governor's candidates drive to the polls and the U.S. Senate candidate, mostly Sherrod Brown, drives to the polls will affect who is there to vote for these individuals. I don't know if there's going to be a lot of split tickets on these. One race that is drawing some interest outside of general political talk is the attorney general's race between Steve Dettelbach, the Democrat, former U.S. attorney, and then Dave Yost, Republican, current state auditor. That has hinged a lot on this electronic classroom of tomorrow in ECOT, and Dettelbach has been very critical of Dave Yost not doing enough to really audit and police that charter school, which closed earlier this year. So that's one race that's been interesting. And I think if voters are paying attention, the Secretary of State's race could be very interesting between Frank LaRose, the Republican, and Kathleen Clyde, the Democrat. They both have similar experience in the state legislature. Both are very well versed in these types of things. But I think you would see a different approach to, like, removing voters from the polls, for example, or like a voter's bill of rights would be something that maybe the Democrat would be more
for.
Yeah, I agree, especially with the attorney general's race. I think that's going to be a real race. Now, you look at Secretary of State, Kathleen Clyde versus Frank LaRose. You look at up and down both parties' statewide tickets, there's only one other woman running for one of these state constitutional offices, and that's Betty Sutton, who is Rich Cordray's running mate. Kathleen Clyde is the only woman who is running for one of these offices, and I think that that could be an advantage for her because she does have a great appeal among Democrats, and especially African-American Democrats who are concerned about what they perceive as Republican attacks on their right to vote. And if you add that to women voting for women, then, you know, that may turn the tide for her.
And I might just point out that in the treasurer race, Rob Richardson, who's from down here, is the only African-American
exactly
on that. Jesse, do you think any of these campaigns are going to come up with enough money to get to TV and make sort of a splash in the last several weeks of the campaign?
Well, I think so, especially in those so-called down-ticket races. The Democrats have been fundraising very well, frequently outraising their Republican counterparts. And I think because there is a lack of attention to some of these races until the very end when voters realize they're on their ballots, I think they might reserve some of that money until the final weeks of the election. So I think you could see some ads for folks other than the governor and U.S. Senate race. Also, just worth noting, and there are a number of women running for Ohio Supreme Court as well.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Which is statewide. Well, I want to thank Joe and Jesse for being with us today. Howard, please stay right where you are for the next segment.
Okay.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. Election laws and regulations can be complicated and may seem at times overly picky. But everyone has a purpose that, taken together, are designed to reassure citizens that elections are run fairly and openly. In this election cycle, several controversies have emerged locally. One involves certain spending practices in the Aftab-Pureval congressional campaign. Just yesterday, the Ohio Elections Commission agreed to review those charges. The case has also entangled the highest-ranking Democratic employee at the Hamilton County Board of Elections. That is being dealt with locally. The other challenge involves charges that Anderson Township trustee Andrew Pappas falsely claimed to have personally witnessed certain signatures on a petition to roll back the county tax this summer. To discuss these issues, I am joined by WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson. Joining Howard is Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Scott Wortman and Cincinnati Enquirer columnist Jason Williams. To join our discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Welcome, everyone.
Thanks,
Howard,
for having us.
Thank you for staying.
Thank you.
You know, we really have two issues when we start out with the Pureval question. And one is the actual spending, what was spent, how it was spent, where it came from, all of that. And the other one is what happened to the Board of Elections. Let's start with the actual spending part. Mm-hmm. Scott, would you just sort of clarify
Yes. What's
at stake there? What is really the question that's involved?
Well, and it was curious when this came up at the end of July. Aftab Pureval is running a congressional campaign, one of the most visible races in the country. And his campaign submitted a report at the end of July, but not for his congressional campaign, for his clerk of courts campaign, which he won 2 years ago and is not up for re-election for another 2 years, and it showed $30,000 worth of new spending. So the logical question is, why are you spending on this race? And it's come out, a lot of the spending, most of it was to this GBA Strategies, which did a congressional poll for his congressional race. Several of them, yes. And then there was also money spent on a photographer who happened to also just take photographs of his launch for his congressional campaign. And you're not allowed to spend money on a local race for a federal race.
Okay. So he had different pots of money, mm-hmm. and each of those pots is regulated mm-hmm. By the laws and the regulations of the Board of Elections.
And one of the reasons for that is there are federal campaign spending limits, $5,400 per donor, but there aren't those limits on a local race. And Aftab's mother had given $15,000 on the local campaign.
Jason, how serious are the legal issues on this?
I think Howard, probably having seen this for so long, can attest, probably speak to this even better. But I honestly don't. I think ultimately it's probably could be dismissed as a amateur campaign error. You know, there are a lot of people who can finagle it and get away with using two campaigns. You do it more stealthily. But I ultimately think probably the worst thing that happens is he gets fined by the Ohio Elections Commission or, you know, and maybe that ruling doesn't come down until January or February, like long after the election. And then you know, who knows then if the FEC would even take it up, but they would take 2 years probably to deal with it. So,
yeah, I mean, it's, I agree with Jason. I mean, it's nobody's going to jail over this.
Okay. Even though there is a commercial out there that indicates.
I know what there is a commercial out there.
Yeah.
Sometimes they tend to exaggerate.
Yeah, they do. And
what? I'm shocked.
That's what happens in these cases. And the Ohio Elections Commission has an obligation to look at these things no matter what. You know, if it comes up before them, if there is a charge made, they have an obligation to look at it. That's what they're going to do. They could decide, and there's probable cause to look at it to see whether or not a law was broken with some of the spending that Scott was describing. Now, that does not mean that – I think it most likely would mean that – as Jason says, that the campaign would be fined. There would be some sort of fine. They would be slapped on the wrist. They would say, don't ever do that again. And that this was, in effect, it just seems to me, it just feels to me like having covered a few of these races before, it just seems to me like an amateur job.
Sort of what Jason was just saying.
Right. There were just some amateur mistakes that were made.
I was wondering if there was a part of this that AFTAB at the end of last year wasn't expecting to run this race. There was a lot of pressure on him in early January, and it was, you know, scrambling to figure out whether he was going to get in. Did he have any prayer? Saw a pot of money, spent some stuff.
Well, he certainly had the ambition.
Oh, he had the ambition. I don't.
Yeah.
But he also didn't want to.
But he was realistic.
He wasn't on a suicide mission either.
Right. He was realistic about it. Yeah. Until he could be assured that he could raise the money, until the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee could be assured that he could go out and raise money to be competitive. And there was no point in running if you could not be competitive.
Right.
And I think his campaign's learning that on a race of this magnitude, there are thousands of eyeballs on every move that you make. And
not only locally.
Yeah.
Nationally.
And there's a lot at stake in this
race. It's not the clerk of courts race anymore.
Yeah. Right. No. Now, the other side of that is, you know, if this becomes even more of an issue – there are things that he can run against Steve Chabot. There
sure.
was a funding question with Steve Chabot over the years.
Right.
You know, so you can, you know, this becomes tit for tat too.
And it has, and it's certainly become that. And the whole race has been that. It's,
yeah.
And yeah. There's going to be like dueling commercials on this, you know, these so-called alleged improprieties from now till November.
Here's a.
How much of a – I'm sorry, I didn't mean that.
No, okay.
How much of a factor – I mean, is this going to be even on voter suppression and how people vote? I mean, I don't even know how many voters, you know, base their decision off of issues like this.
Scott, I don't know who – I can't imagine what voter is going to be stopped from voting because of, you know, how this $30,000 was spent.
See,
I just can't.
I think voters generally – like. Probably don't really view campaign finance issues, especially something like this, as a big deal. I think it became a big deal, and an error made by his campaign this week when you're asking the Board of Elections to redact public documents. And that's, to me, like you just tripped over yourself, and you made pretty much what's ultimately probably going to be a non-issue into an issue, or now you have to question transparency and secrecy and –
do you think that's an issue for Purval's campaign, or is it an issue for Sally Crystal, the deputy director at the Board of Elections, who was the one who actually struck this out, who blacked out the memo line on these checks?
I think both. The GOP is already using it to just ask a general question on what are they hiding, even though we know what the checks are now
for. Yeah,
we
know what the memos
mindset. But now they can just paint it with a broad brush saying, well, what are they hiding?
Yeah.
I don't know. Sally Crystal, you know, when AFTAB's campaign manager came in and said, you know, can we do this legally? And Sally said, yes, you can, as long as the purpose of the spending was listed in the campaign filing itself. And but what she would, instead of handing her pen over to
Sarah Toppe,
the campaign manager, and saying, "Here, you redact this," she did it herself. That was a mistake. She'll have, there will be consequences for that at the Board of Elections, but it's not, you know, it's, Tim Burke, the chairman, made it clear that she's not going to be fired. She did nothing really illegal. She did something that was in bad judgment. And I think the whole board would agree
with that.
It
looks bad.
Yeah, it looks bad.
Yeah.
And that's what Alex kept saying. This looks bad.
But Alex, you know, had used this hearing where he was hammering at Sally about exactly what happened. And it wasn't – it was almost not about Sally, but it was more about AFTAB and more about AFTAB's campaign. And it came right after they had had this hearing, or so-called hearing, or tried to have a hearing on this Pappas matter, which was one of his people under attack.
Well, let's go there. Scott, get us started on the Pappas matter. And we're talking about Andrew Pappas, who's a trustee, elected official in Anderson Township. Very close, a Republican, very close to Alex Triantafilo on lots of levels. So what's at stake there? What's the question there?
Well, this goes back to a petition that's now kind of a moot point, but it goes back to the sales tax petition to stop the sales tax hike that the county commissioners wanted to put in place. They ended up pulling that for political reasons involving the AFTAB Pure Bowl.
Oh, is that what it was?
Well, technically, no, but wink, wink, nudge, nudge. One of the petition leaders was Anderson Township trustee Andrew Pappas, who's a very vocal GOP, local GOP politician. And he circulated petitions in his dry cleaning businesses. Some of his opponents said he's developed a lot of political enemies because he's pretty controversial or pretty confrontational online. Petitions has 10 signatures on it, dated in mid-July, but he also happened to be posting for Michigan at that same period.
And, while he was on vacation.
Yes, while he was on vacation. So people were asking, how could this possibly be? How could he be gathering signatures when he's hundreds of miles away?
You're required, if you were a circulator, you were required to witness
Correct. The
signatures.
Yes, yeah. And he swore on the petition form that he personally witnessed the signatures.
And, you know, those – that signature, the passing of signatures, the distribution, and signing it down at the bottom that you witnessed this, there are a lot of things about petitions that people, you know, they get approached all the time, may not understand. I mean, I've had a friend who was charged with misrepresenting what the petition was really about. And most of the people who had circulated petitions in that particular race just said, this is all going to go away. This friend who doesn't give up easily got a lawyer and said, no, my name's on this. I didn't misrepresent anything. So there are real details on these petitions that, again, probably the average person out there doesn't realize. But the Board of Elections takes them seriously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things about Pappas is that after all this was brought up, and it was brought up by a group of Anderson Township Democrats who, as Scott says, have lively discussions with him all the time on social media and elsewhere, that they came in and complained. And they put all this together. They matched up the dates, you know, the signatures and the dates of him sitting on his boat in Bar Harbor, Michigan, which was really not probably the smartest thing to do. And, you know, if you knew you had these petitions being signed back home, but I don't know what he knew. But he apologized, and he said that he had signed this sheet with the 10 signatures and the 8 from that day by mistake. and filed them, and he apologized. He did mea culpa, mea maxima culpa. I'm so sorry. This will never happen again. But then he didn't show up at the Board of Elections meeting. They wanted to talk to him further about it. And so it ended up, because he didn't show up, there was a vote taken to subpoena him, to bring him in front of the Board of Elections to explain himself with a court reporter present. And that was a 2-2 vote, Republicans, Democrats, and the Secretary of State's going to have to decide whether or not he's going to be dragged into the Board of Elections to explain himself.
Jason, what's the ultimate – again, what's the ultimate what's Andrew Pappas facing? How many years?
Just a slap on the wrist, and it probably isn't going to come to that because the Secretary of State is a Republican who's
– He is, but I'll give him credit, though. I mean, a lot of these cases, especially when they're issuing subpoenas, he'll go on, not on party lines.
I think the fact that, that the whole situation ultimately has gone away, the fact that he's apologized for it, I think at the end of the day, like there's –
And they'll just write it off as, okay, you did something stupid, so
don't do it again.
Apologize for it. Right.
And really a mistake not to just show up and just
get
it over with.
Right.
And say what he had said in writing before the board.
It was a very bad mistake not showing up.
Not a good,
I think both of these issues are kind of like political quicksand. The more you try and fight it, the deeper you'll sink.
Yeah. I want to get back to the Purevall Shabbat race. One of the real issues that is being brought up is whether or not Steve Shabbat has lost contact with the people in his district, which is a charge that's made against almost any politician who's been in the same office for a long time. And Purevall's raising it on sort of cute little ways on a TV commercial talking to kids that he's listening to the kids, which is a cute commercial, but also raising the fact that Steve Shabbat has so far refused to debate face to face with him. So, how important is this, Jason? That do the people of the first congressional district deserve to see these two face to face?
I believe they do, and I they will. There's actually three debates now have been scheduled, and it's funny we had it. One of those are being hosted by us. And we had an internal meeting about it this morning, and I just sort of jokingly said, I was like, is this really set? I mean, are we really going to have this? And they said yes, that they worked hard to get Shabbat committed and that he's locked in. And so that's on October 30th, and that's the last – there's a couple more before that. I don't know the dates off the top of my head. But I think it's going to be a good thing. I think it's going to be interesting to see those two on the same stage, and I think people deserve it. And knowing this is a nationally watched race and how intense things are nationally and with the whole Trump factor, people deserve to be able to hear from the candidates.
And we may have the two of them in this very room.
We would like to.
Yeah, we would like to, and we're waiting. What we're waiting for is a word from the Shabbat campaign that they'll do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Scott, as you're out there covering this race, what are you hearing? How is it looks lively from a distance?
Yes.
Is this something that's being talked about out in the communities?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And even Republicans will admit that AFTAB's very charismatic and not an opponent that really Shabbat has faced before. And it's amazing how much AFTAB has gained on Shabbat in the few months that in the minds of the public that he has a real shot at this, and it might not even be an upset.
Yeah. Well, I was actually I drove through a lot of Warren County last weekend. I went camping at Caesars Creek, and so I was on a lot of back roads, and I saw a lot of signs for AFTAB and even for Shabbat, more AFTAB. But I was surprised because those are the only really signs I've seen. You don't see a lot of signs for the governor's race or any of these other races. But there were a lot of signs out for that. And I was thinking, like, there's some enthusiasm there for this race.
And he's actually drawn fairly large crowds in Warren County, which is very Republican, and that was at the start of the race seen as the biggest impediment, which it probably still is, to AFTAB winning because it went heavily for Trump.
What people don't understand, though, about Warren County is Warren County's changing, too. And there are a whole lot of new people coming into Warren County who, and they may be Republicans or call themselves Republican or lean Republican, but they're not necessarily Trump Republicans. They're not, you know, they haven't bought into the whole Trump thing, and they look at somebody, and AFTAB wants them to look at Steve Chabot as someone who has tied himself so closely to Trump that they're in lockstep. And that he can win over those new voters in Warren County. Warren County is not as quite as solidly Republican as it used to be. You look at the margin in 2016 for Trump, and it was one of the lowest in any Republican county in the state. It was something like 6%.
Well, it raises the whole.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
It raises that whole question too about suburban women.
Right.
And
exactly.
So it's sort of a test case of, you know, this is a suburban area of Cincinnati. Does this play out here as they're being talked about around the country?
And that's who he's targeting.
And I think, you know, what we saw in the special election in Ohio's 12th district is you saw some similarities there in that you had a chunk of the urban county and then you had an entire Delaware county, which was somewhat equivalent to Warren County. Now, that district's a little different because it has also chunks of, what, three or four other rural counties, which is Trump territory. So that's why Balderson ultimately won that, the Republican ultimately won that. But, you know, you can look at kind of what Delaware County did, and it did not go so much for the Republican. That's why the race was so close. Mm-hmm. And you can look at that and think, maybe that's what Warren County is going to do. And if that's what happens, then Steve Chabot's in big trouble.
Yes, I agree.
So any other local race out there? We've got about a minute left. Any other local race that you're following that you think is maybe got a surprise in it?
I'll tell you, these things have sucked all the air out of the room. There's hardly anything else on the ballot that is going to match that. I mean, you know, obviously issue one is a big thing.
And
we've talked about that before.
And we will cover that here too.
Oh, yes, absolutely. But as far as candidate races, I feel sorry for some of these guys because they cannot get through the noise.
Yeah.
You know, they can't cut through the noise.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank Howard, Scott, Jason for being here on a Friday. As you always are, thank you. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. Segment producer is Layla Shakui. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our program are available on the website, wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.